How's it going, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Breaking Point podcast. Today we're here with Irina, or is it Irina?
It doesn't really matter. It's like how it is easier for you to pronounce. Yeah. Irina.
Okay, we'll go with Irina. And she is a counselor and hypnotherapist, and we're going to have a talk about her and therapy and her opinions on therapy and how she interacts with her clients and guests. So, Irina, tell the people a little bit about yourself and how you got into counseling and hypnotherapy and whatever else you're into.
I started my journey to where I am right now 18 years ago when I finished my medical degree, and I decided the next step for me is a career of psychiatrist. So I did my internship in psychiatry and then another one in forensic psychiatry. So I was working in a like mixed department where we had one hospital and one forensic examination. And I worked as a forensic psychiatrist for 9 years, somewhere around like this. When I decided that the career path is kind of not interested for me anymore to explore. I explore everything, and it felt like a routine. There was nothing new for me. So then I decided to change my career, and I started my PhD in neuroscience in Edinburgh University. And after that, I work as a research assistant. When COVID hit, I lost funding for my projects and didn't know what to do with my life anymore, because it felt like, there's nothing. You know, I couldn't do my research. I couldn't do any work with the participants. I couldn't apply for any research job because there was no funding at that time, or I was just unlucky. So I had to pivot again. And I decided want to just help people going through COVID. I brushed off my clinical education, clinical learning, and I did a little bit of hypnotherapy when I was in psychiatry residency. And we did a lot of psychodynamic interventions with our patients. Yeah. So I just, put the word out there that's me. If you need a talk for free, if you're going through something really terrible, that's me. You can just have a conversation with me. And I had an overwhelming desire of this kind of help. Yeah. People were unemployed. People couldn't pay money for anything. So, but they were going through a really rough patch. And so my free therapy session, kind of like, I didn't call them therapy session, just a talking sessions, because I wasn't qualified in the UK as their psychiatrist, psychotherapist. So that was me for a year just doing sessions, because firstly, I was in a kind of void of, I don't know what to do, what I am, what to do in the future. And there was a strong calling to help other people. And then it kind of like quite enjoy that. I really want that to be my next step at helping people. So I did lots of different courses to help me to be qualified in the UK as a psychotherapist. So right now I'm integrity of psychotherapist, meaning that in my... under my belt, there's psychodynamic or psychoanalytic practices, somatosensor psychotherapy, clinical hypnotherapy, person-centered therapy, gestalt therapy. So I did try to get as many as I could, the one that I felt talked to me. So this is where I am right now. I work primarily with trauma, because this is where I feel much more impact needed than anything else. But I do work with different other, with the breakups, with eating disorder, anxiety, depression, all sort of things. But my focus is on trauma therapy.
Brilliant. So when people say trauma, when therapists say trauma, what classifies as trauma? Is it dependent upon the person's reaction to an event, or is it an actual classified list of things that is considered trauma?
It can be either. It can be quite traumatic, objectively traumatic, or episode in life, or sexual abuse, or physical abuse. It could have been car accident, passing over a carer. So I have a couple of clients who were bringing the siblings on their own because parents were alcoholics or drug addicts. That's a sort of trauma. And also a small t trauma. I don't want to kind of put it in a smaller position as though it's insignificant. It is very significant.
Course,
but we had more of the small t trauma. Kids who felt abandoned by the parents, even though parents really objectively did the best they could. But as a kid, we always perceive maybe events a bit differently, a bit more traumatic. All right. Even the little things like we perceive, that's not a big deal. You know, I'm so tired after a long day at work, and my kid is bringing me a picture that they were drawing all day. And you say, like, well, good picture, right? It can be quite traumatic. And they will, from there, it starts a ray of perfectionism. I need to do more. I need to strive more. I need to do more of whatever, you know, to get this praise from a parent. Even though, you know, I love my kids, and, you know, but we're all going to mess up in a little ways. That will lead maybe for this small t trauma will lead to something in an adult life.
Yeah, or they can sort of accumulate. Because I watched a video with a guy who said the true way that you punish a child isn't by telling them when they've done something wrong, it's by not applauding them when they've done something right. Because that, And as you just said, the parents had a long day at work, and then they're like, maybe the child's annoyed them for 2 hours, and then they go away and they do something and they go, Mummy, Daddy, look what I've done. And you're a bit like, yep, cool. And they're really, you know, emphatic about it, but your reaction doesn't match theirs. And then it creates that sort of void that they fall into. So that's really interesting that you bring that up. What is your... Do you have a favorite, I know you said trauma, but do you have a favorite approach to clinical psychology? Do you like the Freud and the psychodynamic, or do you prefer the more, do you know what I mean? Do you have one that you think, or do you think they all have utility?
I absolutely love clinical hypnotherapy, and we can use clinical hypnotherapy together with so many different types of other therapies. Person-centered is a essence of all therapies. All therapies, I believe, need to be person-centered. Yeah. There is no way around it.
Absolutely.
And psychodynamic is when we in hypnotherapy diving in your past and seeing the root, exactly how I said, you know, a very punitive parent who really, really wanted for a kid to reach the pinnacle, you know, like reach the career pinnacle, how they are asking a lot from a kid. And the kid was like, oh my God, it's so much pressure on me. And internalize that in a way like a kid can do, only very subjective, right? So when we go psychodynamically in hypnotherapy to the root cause of the problem and see it's in a more objective way, like as though we're watching a football game and we see exactly where their ball needs to be passed on or which player, right? But we can't see it when we are in the game. So we almost see the same situation, but on the screen, how objectively that was, and that this kind of reformulation in your mind what actually happened without any emotional involvement, without any subjectivity, without any, like, that's my story point of view, but very objective. That was the kid, that was a parent, for example, right? And this is the situation. I understood the situation really wrongly. In a moment, we can give ourselves their understanding to that little kid, understanding what is actually happening. So when they're coming out of hypnosis, they say, oh my gosh, all my life, I built my life story based on that event. I don't need to do that anymore because that event was false. So that is psychodynamic. In a gestalt or somatosensor psychotherapy, we can, for gestalt, we can see how we can complete something that we felt was uncompleted in the past. And really, trauma is something that we didn't finish in our mind, something that keeps circling. Mm-hmm. We are looking for a situation that would complete that story, that would complete that gestalt. So in hypnotherapy, we can complete that gestalt because for our mind, it doesn't really matter if it's in a real life or it's imagined. So we go back to that situation. For example, people were in an abusive relationship and they couldn't do what they meant to be doing in that abusive relationship. You know, scream, shout, protect, ask for help rather than swallow and sweep out of the rug. Therefore, all following relationship will be falling in the same pattern of abusive, of neglectful, or humiliation. So we complete the gestalt on the first relationship. We complete what we're meant to be doing. So there is no need for repetition in following relationship. So that's a gestalt in hypnotherapy. And we all, for example, made out of parts. One part is very anxious for us, trying to protect. So we can go in hypnotherapy and talk to that anxious part. What are you trying to achieve? What is the protection that you are trying to give us? We don't need that protection. We're already not small kids because usually these anxious parts were created when we were kids. So we'll work with parts. So hypnotherapy is such a diverse way how you can communicate with things that we need in a moment. So I absolutely love that. But yeah, hypnotherapy in itself is a very little because usually hypnotherapists, they use lots of scripts, which is very generic, which is not very reflective of what a person is going through in a moment. I don't like using scripts. I never use scripts. I work in a moment with the person, with a personal problem, using personal language that they would give me before we go in hypnosis. So that is my approach. Love hypnotherapy.
That's really good. Yeah. No, I agree because I've had a lot of anxiety in my life and I've had a lot of therapy, particularly sort of CBT. And I think one of the things that CBT can miss out on is the somatic, so the bodily sensations of anxiety and how trauma can be trapped in the body. And, you know, there are some, so I guess hypnotherapy is it kind of like a delving into the unconscious? Is that one way of looking at it, or is that not accurate?
Very much delving into the subconscious because all our problems root in subconscious. It's, for example, I'm going to give you an example about you that you just gave me. I am quite anxious person, right? And I will tell you, your conscious mind, yeah, stop being anxious. It's just silly to be nervous about little things, right?
Yeah.
For example, going on a plane or being around white people, what can be so frightening and difficult? And consciously, you would say like, yeah, that is really silly, but it's a ridiculous thing to say to an anxious person because it's not going to resolve anxiety, isn't it? Because that is subconscious. It's very emotionally driven, very wired mechanism. So it is subconscious. So for me, it was always bizarre to resolve problems in a conscious mind when the problem is in subconscious. Mm-hmm. You know, we almost hypnotize ourselves all our lives to be anxious about certain events. You self-hypnotize yourself on thinking about events of being threatened. So it's bizarre to go and doing conscious work when the root is in subconscious. There were studies,
yeah,
because I've done lots of memory studies. There were studies on deep divers, and they let them learn about things on the ground and then dived in a certain level, you know, like underwater, and recall that, I don't know, like words, for example. Right? And they couldn't do that. The recall was much lower than recall they would go back to their ground and recall on their dry land, right? Then they did the same. They gave them to read their certain words underwater and recall on the ground. And recall, again, was much lower than recall under the water. So we need to be positioned in the same kind of state in order to recall something or understand something. So I'm putting people on the same subconscious level where they encoded their wrongness of the event. And it is on a moment the only capacity we could do, but really encoding that way objectively was wrong as a word, but you know, it's misleading. It was misleading. Something was said to you, you internalized that, and you wouldn't want to go on social events because you think that, the same will happen, which is statistically quite impossible, isn't it? So that's why I feel we need to go to subconscious to resolve all these things. You know, we need to be positioned in the same frame of mind where we encoded. Also, you searched
it's called,
We also can work in somatic and hypnotherapy. We can go back to their anxious situation and say, but right now my body is relaxed. I'm breathing really deeply. So it means there is no threat for me from that situation. And you encode it on the subconscious level. So when you consciously go on the same situation, you already automatically will go on the relaxed and calm state rather than anxious, tense, and shallow breathing. So we work with body in the hypnotherapy. It's already a relaxed state. So we just anchor that state. So when you go out there, that will be your right now intuitive and automatic reaction on the safe situation.
Yeah. Conditioning. Yeah, that's really good. My perception of childhood is like you're walking down a path and these obstacles come up in front of you. And if it's a pretty big, a lot of the time you can just hop over them or something. But if it's a pretty big obstacle, a part of you gets stuck behind the obstacle and then the rest of you carries on going. And what I would imagine that a way of what happens in hypnotherapy is you go back in a sort of strange way and you remove the obstacle and then that part of you comes flying back to your present state and it shifts your perception of everything, at least. And that's what I think you encounter a lot of people. And you said something earlier about how a lot of trauma was a result of being a child. And if you can just get through to someone that you're not a child anymore, you're not the 5-year-old that this awful thing happened to, you're now a 35-year-old, fully grown adult. A lot of trauma is a result of their subconscious not being able to contemplate that change of who they are and then still being the 5-year-old living inside, which we all are. We're all the child. Our inner childs are all living inside of us. But do you understand what I mean? Is that an interesting, is that a good way of putting it, that sort of obstacle? And then
But I would describe it as not removing the obstacle, because I like obstacles. I think this is where growth is happening. My growth happens every time I encounter the obstacle, so I don't like removing the obstacle. I like to give in resources, you know, capacity to jump over, you know, have better strength, better understanding, more legwork, you know, better muscles, better maybe resilient. But you need that obstacle. So I wouldn't want to remove that obstacle. I wouldn't want to remove anything from your life. Your life was amazing learning course. I just want you to have a bit more strength, muscle pull, or more like breathing, you know, like to breathe through the obstacles. But you absolutely have to have that obstacle. I wouldn't want to remove that, you know, to make the life easy. That would be a really boring life. But yeah, we will. And it's the silly to think that there will be no obstacles, right? And, you know, we will be removing obstacles. No, we'll have better capacity. You know, we can jump higher, we can run faster, we can breathe or hold the breath for a longer time. This is what I want, right? Because we want that excitement and obstacles and overcoming that and overcoming again and be on a different spiral. But we want that. We want challenging people in our life. We want challenging situation in our life. This is how the growth happens. But yeah, I like the metaphor and obstacle. Yeah. And hypnotherapy is very metaphorical language. And even in my talk at therapy, I do like a lot to use metaphors because it's kind of more objective. It's not really about, we're not talking about you anymore. It's kind of ephemeral story, but you connect straight away because subconscious is only about imagery. It's not about language. It's not about emotion. It's only imagery. It's only about metaphors, you know, what we go through life. Yeah.
That's really good, yeah.
And I wouldn't want for you to get rid of maybe part of you being a child because, well,
yeah.
We need to. It's like childlike way of being, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah. And also, you're spot on. It's not about getting rid of the obstacles. It's about adding skills to your arsenal to contend with future obstacles and growing yourself out and completing. You know, I guess that's the ideal, but is expanding your capacity, as you said. Yeah, 100%. Brilliant. So you mentioned how you, COVID, what sort of research psychologist were you? Because a lot of people know what clinical psychology is, but not, I don't think many people know the difference, that there's another aspect of psychology, which is research psychology. So tell people what that is.
In the beginning, when I did my PhD, I was very interested from forensic psychiatry point of view, how people make decision about finances. And that was my research, that was my PhD, that was my post-PhD program about nothing to do with what I do right now. In a way, it was a lot of executive functioning, things that we can attend or shadow their attention, so we'll remove all the background noise and we can be focused. So that executive function, a lot about memory, long-term and short-term memory. So that was research about how we can understand finances. I don't know if it's that interesting because finance is a very multidimensional level. One is like just, you know, buying stuff without thinking, and another level completely is understanding investments and stocks market and all that. So it's like very layered. So I was trying to kind of like build upon when we are starting to lose that idea of what finances are and how we are losing a little by little capacity to understand finances. So that was my research about. But then when you hit the problem, you kind of need to pivot and grow out, you know, understand where you need to say, that's it. I exhausted that and I can't push anymore. I had a very interesting discussion today with my client that I just had before you. There was a breakup in the relationship. And sometimes we want to push, like, let's try more. Let's try maybe a different strategy when there is really no way forward. So you need to stay like, that's it. I'm defeated. And the best way right now is to step out of the situation and be for yourself. But in most of the time, we burn ourselves out to pursue something unpursuable. So that was me then when I decided I exhausted that. And I need to just put a white flag and say, that's it. I can't do it with this, anything else. So I completely pivot. And right now, my research is about resilience in that neurodiverse people and how we're going through, how they are going through life. I'm a neurotypical, but I am fascinated by the world of neurodiverse people, like people with autism, ADHD, and dyslexia, because it's a very fascinating world. We are pathologizing that a lot, and I want to stop doing that because I think it's just a different world. that because from neurotypicality, we think, well, that's pathology, but it's not. This is my perception of it. And I want to find, and I want to use language of impactfulness and how much strength they have. So this is why I do research on resilience and how to bring on that resilience in people who are going through maybe diagnosis of being neurodiverse and challenges that they face in a neurotypical world. I don't know, maybe neurotypicality will be and minority very soon because we diagnose more and more people with ADHD and autism, which is fascinating. And because I work also at the university, I am now teaching clinical psychology at the university. And I do have lots of students who are neurodiverse, and how can I give them, information that they can go through quite challenging time of academia without any setbacks? How can I maybe shape my teaching for neurotypical and for neurodiverse people that they are in the same kind of level?
That's really interesting that you talk that you're pursuing resilience, because I worked in a special needs school with a lot of children on the spectrum, and you know it's the term the spectrum is thrown around and now thrown around a lot nowadays, and that everyone says, oh well, everyone's on the spectrum. What's your opinion of that term, everyone's on the spectrum? Is it accurate? Or
I feel yes. You know, when we're talking about even things like personality, right? We're all on the spectrum of personality, like we are all shifted, and we are going into certain extremes when there are certain extreme situations present. And yes, sir, we are in a certain spectrum, but in a lay way, like we would use the word, oh, I'm very OCD about certain things. You know, you're not having OCD, you know, like if you want your house to be clean and tidy. But this is the language that we're comfortable with. Yeah. The same kind of, in that very clinical way, we are all on the spectrum, but in a very lay way so we can understand what spectrum is.
Okay, that's a good point. What do you mean, so we can understand what spectrum is? What do you mean by that?
Because, you know, for example, introverted people, sometimes mistakenly understood as like, oh, they're more on a spectrum than not, because they are not bothered to understand the inner world, right? Or if they are incredibly smart and incredibly capable, or they're probably also in a spectrum or like some sort of Asperger, and we're looking for into that. And this is how lay people kind of make sense of the world. That's what I meant.
No, I love the Big Five personality. I think it's brilliant. Now that I've got a kind of in-depth, thorough understanding of it, I spend my entire life when I meet people just going, sort of placing them on the dimensions and going, I think it's brilliant. It makes complete sense. I think everyone should have some form of understanding of it. It's really important. And you're right, as one of the things that I've realized as I got older is, as humans, we stereotype. Stereotyping is a necessary ability for humans. We have to stereotype. And a lot of the time it's helpful, in the sense of, if I walk out in front of that bus, I'm going to probably get hit and probably die. That's a helpful stereotype that we've all made. But unfortunately, there are unhelpful stereotypes as well. And it's hard to work out what the two to differentiate between. Well, no, it's not hard to. Maybe it is hard to differentiate between what a good stereotype and a bad stereotype is. But the key is understanding that stereotypes aren't all bad, but they can be. They can be pathological and they can be negative. Do you understand what I mean?
Again, as a researcher, I read a lot of paper. There was an amazing, fascinating research about it, and we're doing that. Replicating that research. There was a camera built with no air. There was air, but there was no sound, no smells, or no any light coming in. Completely, almost vacuum, with ability to breathe, right? But nothing else can penetrate. And animals will put in a camera. And what do you think would happen with our animal that would put in a camera out of all sight, that is no sight at all? What do you think would happen to the animal?
You mean camera, as in like a...
Like a box.
Camera.
Like a box where you can go in, but with air, but no sight at all. No hearing. You can't hear anything. You can't smell anything. You can't see anything. Completely blackness.
Okay. Okay. An animal.
I'll give you...
Sit down and relax.
Yeah, sit down and relax. And no, they will fall asleep because it's incredibly peaceful. You can't hear anything, you can't smell anything, you can't see anything. That's very, very peaceful for an animal. When person was put in that sort of box camera thing, they will completely lose their mind. Completely. We can't survive without outside things coming out. You know, like all the senses, they need to be involved. Because our brain immediately need to make sense of it. And brain can't make sense when there is nothing to make sense out of. So we will be imagining horrible things in that camera. And that was proved by scientists who do this sort of experiment. People would go absolutely crazy, so anxious, so worried, so absolutely almost to the point of traumatized, they would be removed before that, you know, horrible thing would happen. But that is the sense of our brain. That is why we need to have a story. This is why we need to make sense. This is why we're always, no matter what, something happening in our body, we need to make sense. This is why anxiety happens when the heart starts breathing. This is why panic attack happens. Because we need to make sense. We are making sense kind of animals in a sort of way that we are animalistic beings, how we are intuitive, and how we automatically react to a certain situation. But we're also making sense things that we were given this cortex for the reason. We need to create sense of the world. That's why we have a problem, and animal don't. That's why we do therapy, because we need to make sense objectively rather than from the subjective point of view.
Yeah. Does the human mind actually see things objectively? Are we capable of seeing things objectively? Or can we only retrospectively see things objectively? Are our brains subjective? Is the way we see something completely and utterly dependent upon us as an individual? Or are we capable of seeing something as it truly is?
If it doesn't involve us, then I would say yes. But it's still, there's a sense of subjectivity in there. But if that's the situation for us, I would say that it's a very unlikely that we'll see situation as objective. Again, that's why hypnotherapy is so amazing, because we can actually put that situation in an objective screen and see that as it is. Without us actually being in a picture, we see a person that looks like us, well, us, and another person, and we see what is actually happening. This is why we can make a better sense of the situation we've gone through and come out of that with a better understanding why we created that story, right? And make another different story for us, so we can be thriving, we can achieve things, we can be the better version of ourselves and being incredibly resourceful next time. So yeah, I would say that's a tricky question, but I think there is always a sense of subjectivity in
them. Yeah.
And that's brilliant.
It is brilliant. Yeah. That's vital, isn't it, for us as a species to continue, because, you know, we all need, and it's a cliche, we're all different, but we're all different for a reason, so that we can navigate through both individually and societally, as, you know, through the world. Yes, there's a quote, or I watched something, and they said, we are meaning-making machines, and we live our lives through a narrative lens. And that's so true, isn't it? Everything is a narrative. Everything that ever happens to us is a narrative. And it has to have meaning. And if you don't have meaning, you become nihilistic, which is actually still a meaning. It's a meaning of suffering and pain.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Beautiful. Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Yeah. Do you know who this, the philosopher Hobbes? He said something like, he said, there was a philosopher who said, man in the state of nature is short, brutish, and violent, or something like that. And his theory was that we were inherently chaotic, dangerous beings, and it was society and culture that kept us in shape. And then there was another guy called Rousseau. I already knew about it, but it came up this morning somewhere. Another guy called Rousseau who said the exact opposite. He said that culture is what turned us into being aggressive and dangerous, and actually humans are inherently good. And there's a big sort of debate, or maybe there isn't, but some people think Hobbes was right and some people think Rousseau was right. But I think most people think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. We have the capacity to be, you know, evil, to use a better, for lack of a better word, and then we have the capacity to be good as well. What do you think about that? What do you think human nature is?
I think it's absolutely two things together. We are born blank slate completely, and it's what's given to us, what shapes us, what we're going through. This is how we choose, because it's all about black and white, yin and yang. It's all about this equilibrium, right? It's when there is no equilibrium, yeah. We're talking about, oh, that's a bad person, oh, that's a good person. But really, it needs to be an equilibrium. We need to have bad and good, right? It's sort of like bad is for protection. Otherwise, that would be, you know, people would take advantage and we would, you know, there's like always a protection bit, right? We always need to be on our lookout of danger, right? On the protection and protect us as a species, because evolutionary, that is what we need. It's just no matter what is coming, we need to survive that day, right? And protection or negativity or anything, that is what is actually propel us to survive, because that is primarily instinct. Survival. This is what it is, right? And the same with a good one, right? Applies. We need to survive by being good. And what is being good? It being surrounded by people, because if you're not good, you're ostracized and evolutionary, you would never survive. So you need to be kind of like meddling with people and be kind of shaped by people and be people pleaser in a way, you know, because you have to be surrounded by people. And that bit is good, how we're thinking, right? So it needs to be an equilibrium. So I think it's both. But really, when we're born, we're absolutely blank, clean. But then what is coming innately, it's a core. It's like either, neither. It's what shape us, you know, like, and the idea of us to go through the life, to be somewhere in the middle, this is how we kind of adjusted the course, you know, like a little bit here, a little bit there. We can't be 100% good or 90% even good, because it's going to be skewed, you know, too much light and not too much darkness. How can we survive with like only 10% night, you know? It's going to be a really hard life. So the thing, the dark, well,
yeah,
isn't it?
Blind. Yeah, too much light and you'll be blinded, and too much darkness, you'll be stuck. Yeah. So do you actually think that we're all blank? You don't think that we have a temperament dependent upon our genetics? You think we all start off as a blank slate?
Genetics is a thing that can be influenced and manipulated, isn't it? We're all talking, we're not talking genetic term anymore. We're talking epigenetics. Right, and certain genes, even if they given, we're all given certain type of genes, and we can't say like, no, we're not talking about genetics at all. No, we are, but there are so many things that influence our genes to switch on and off. So many, people were born with certain epigenetic, but put them in traumatic situation, and a gene for BPD switch on. And here we go, we have borderline personality disorder, but it needs to be a repeated trauma, repeated social restraints. It needs to be something really significant to switch that gene. The same with diabetes. We all have diabetes gene, but certain only evolution outside sources have to influence that gene of like insulin production. So that definitely trigger. The same with cancer, the same with Alzheimer's. It's all, we're talking epigenetic. And even if you give, given the gene of Alzheimer's and you have the gene open and we can detect that in the blood when we're taken from participants from our studies, right? With certain things that we can do in life, we can switch that gene off. And we will, even though we were given this gene at the beginning, we will never exhibit Alzheimer's disorder because we did everything kind of right by the book. We ate well, we exercise, we are exercising our neuroplasticity by different cognitive training. We're doing everything in order not to get the gene carried away. So yeah, it's all about epigenetics, not genetics in itself. It's all about together, genes and environment together. We can't separate them at all.
So I thought epigenetics was the experiences of our ancestors are coded in their DNA and they're passed down to us. No. Is that not what epigenetics is?
That is epigenetics. Epigenetics is their environment influence your gene expression. That's what epigenetics is.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. So what you're saying is we all have certain propensities and things can lay, traits can lay dormant inside of us and then they can be activated as, that makes complete sense actually, because don't they say that people tend to become more agreeable and more conscientious as they get older? They become more well-rounded individuals as we get older. I read the study about that and I think my people that I know, that makes sense that as you get older, you may, especially if you have kids, maybe you would need to become more agreeable. That's really interesting. I was going to say something again, but that's cool. Okay, epigenetics. I will do some more research on that because I really like that. What things are people, are your clients coming to you with nowadays? What are the preeminent difficulties that people are having, the most common, or are there?
Because I position myself as a trauma therapist, lots of people come to me.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, and again, it's trauma. For example, a recent breakup, that can be traumatic. Recent breakup, quite traumatic. Or I have a client right now who never remembered his dad. He passed away when he was 2. So he has no recollection of his dad. But he kind of will live in that his relationship, passing of his dad. People are living and I'm going to be alone. And that kind of like ingrained his little brain. And I will never, ever be able to connect to anyone because people are living, And can we really say it was true? It was a trauma.
Wow.
And he doesn't even remember that consciously. It's only he remembers that kind of bodily. This is what he's telling me. And when we reflect back and when we work through hypnotherapy, the feeling of this overwhelm of panic, people leaving, it's exactly how he was experienced when he was little. And there was only mom left in his life. He didn't experience, like he didn't understand that, but his body kind of encoded the feeling, I'm alone. And there was nobody to read me a book. There was nobody to put me to bed. You know, this like masculine figure is disappeared in my life. He doesn't remember it consciously, but what he having this, he always, she is leaving again. So we're working through that. So lots of things, quite traumatic. And even with anxiety, I'm working through trauma perspective, because anxiety also happened. Because it was a protection back then from a traumatic experience that we were going through. It can be bullying, and now people are getting anxious about being surrounded by other people or bullying by girls, meaning that they will never be able to get connect to women because they are a source of threat. So I'm working through anxiety and depression also through trauma perspective. And we're thinking right now ADHD might be a traumatic origin. So with people with ADHD, I also kind of like in my mind, there might be something traumatic was going on in childhood. And I need to look into that and help them to cope emotionally with anything that is happening right now. But bearing in mind that it might be a copy how they were survived, how they survived back then when they were little.
That is, yeah, that's really, that is a really cool idea, actually, ADHD being a trauma thing. I think that should be explored a lot more, actually. There could easily be things coming out about that in the future. One thing I want to ask, because I know that I'm running out of time. There's two questions. One is to do with the trauma. You're obviously familiar with Carl Jung, aren't you? Of course you are. How much of people that have encountered malevolence and been abused, how important is it to help them gain a conception of evil and what Jung would describe as integrate their shadow? Do you understand what I mean? Is that one of the techniques that you do when someone's been abused? Do you help them gain an understanding of our ability to be awful?
It's an amazing question, and there will be no answer for everyone. That, you know, I'm doing that for every person who being abused in a absolutely not. But there is an element of, for some people, it's so important to understand why me, and they're coming to me actually to answer that question: why me? Why? People were targeting me. And I remember right now, I had a client who were one of the twins, and she was abused repeatedly from age of 12 to 12, 2 to 12 by her dad. He never touched her absolutely identical twin sister. And the question is, why me? She looks exactly like me. She wore exactly the same clothes as me, playing with the same toys. Wow. She was like my absolute identity, like identical copy. Nobody could tell us apart. Why me? So sometimes, like, why me? What's wrong with me? That is the question. And that's not often the case. But with this kind of question in mind, when people are coming to me, I feel like if that is important, let's work through that. I am working only with what is presented, and I never suggest let's explore this or that. I always lead by what is the most difficult right now to go through. So, but yeah, absolutely, that is an amazing question. Yeah,
that's
the great in our shadow. Yeah.
Thank you for watching the podcast. As always, guys, that was a heavy one. I hope you enjoyed it. Irina was brilliant. I'm not sure why there's no ending to the recording, but there isn't, so I'm doing it now. I apologize for the screen recording. At some point, it goes all fuzzy. I don't know what happened, but I will sort it out and when that happened again. Thank you, as always, for watching. I said that twice, but it's very true. And I'll see you on the next one.